I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Elizabeth West. She's retired from the Santa Fe Public Library, and she's editor of the new book, Santa Fe, 400 Years, 400 Questions. And Adrian Bustamante is a retired historian of Southwest culture, and he wrote the introduction to this book. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Nice to be here.
Thank you.
And there will be a book signing at Collected Works on Monday, the 27th of August at 6 in the evening. Now, this is a really interesting book, 400 questions corresponding to the 400 years that Santa Fe has been in existence, more or less.
Right.
So what was the genesis of this idea to write 400 questions?
This came about because Joe Sanchez, Dr. Joseph Sanchez, who works for the Park Service, had been on the committee when Albuquerque celebrated its 150 years of existence. And he suggested, why don't we do a trivia question, and that way we can inform the public, but it'll also make it, you know, kind of memorable. And then someone came up with the idea of 400 questions for the 400 years. And Maurice Bonal, who's the who was the chair of the committee of the board that ran the 400th celebration, he suggested, why not take it to the newspapers? Well, Anna Pacheco had already kind of said that. So Anna Pacheco at the time, you know, has a relationship with the New Mexican, and so he brought that up. She brought that up, and it went from there. They were happy to do it, of having a question a day, and it seems to have worked really well.
Now, the question was in the paper. Was it also answered the same day, or did people have to come up with the answers?
It was not answered the same day. It was answered the very next day.
Oh, okay.
And that made it kind of fun.
Did people have a chance to come up with their answers or to correct the answers if they thought they weren't right? Or,
well, as a matter of fact, we put in the book somebody who did do that, Richard McCord.
Right.
Found something that was wrong in the paper, and I asked his permission to put it in the book. So the answer is yes to that. But I think mostly people just had fun with it, kind of wondering, what is the next question?
Right.
I have to say that Adrienne and Anna and the rest of the committee were some of the people who came up with a lot of the questions. And some of those were gathered from the people who live in Santa Fe.
Right.
You know?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting because each one of them separately, I'm just going to open the book randomly.
Okay.
And here's question 301. What place established in 1610 has been and still is a physical, commercial, social, and cultural center in Santa Fe?
Ah.
The plaza.
The plaza,
right.
And that's a central question, and pretty much anybody could get that. Another one, what occurred far away in 1810 that led to a new beginning in Santa Fe?
Aha. Uh-huh. See, that's a little bit more difficult.
That's a little
far away where?
Right, right.
And some of these answers, we're not going to give away all the answers,
No,
course.
We're not. Well, we're also not going to read 400 out loud.
Oh, we're not?
On
oh.
this show.
Okay. 1810, that would have been the Mexican revolt against Spain.
El Grito.
Yeah.
El Grito. And that, of course, affected Santa Fe because 12 years later, 11 years later, we come under the Mexican government. Independent Mexico.
Right.
And we were under their government. Mm-hmm.
Now, what I was going to try to get at was that any of these questions, any one of them by itself, you might think, well, this is trivia. But taken together, they start to form some patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And what are some of these patterns that you saw emerging as you were writing and editing and putting together the book?
Well, it changed as we were all working on it, and a small subcommittee of people did do that work. I'd like to just mention their names. It was Adrian, of course, and the late Gerald Gonzalez, Rick Hendricks, state historian here, Michael King, who's director of education at El Rancho de las Golondrinas, Joseph P. Sanchez, who's director of the Spanish Colonial Research Center at the University of New Mexico, and he's superintendent of Petroglyph National Monument, and he still had time to help out. Amazing. Same with Cordelia Thomas Snow, historic sites archaeologist. And the group of us were in touch, sometimes by phone, but usually by email. Mm-hmm. Very modern of us.
Yes.
And I have to say, I volunteered rather innocently to be the editor of this, because all the rest of these folks I've mentioned were extremely busy.
And you had the luxury of being retired from the library.
Yes. It was a lot of work and a lot of fun. But I want to say right here and now, I really would not have been able to do it without these folks that I've mentioned and others. So,
but getting having back said to the question of these of patterns that emerged.
Mm-hmm. It's you could say it's circular. You could say it's totally chaotic. But I choose to say it's somewhat random, which is different from chaotic, as we know. Question might go from one thing to another and circulate around the whole question of what is Santa Fe? What does Santa Fe mean to any one of us individually, to us all as a group? And just the fun of going from one thing to another in a somewhat random way, I think makes it entertaining. It's a little bit like going to a dinner party, and you don't start in the Pleistocene era and go at the soup course to, you know, the Middle Ages and then end with the present. It goes all around the place. And what better place to do that in but Santa Fe, a trading center?
One of the themes that I noticed in the book, and again, it's a book that you can open and just read at random, just choose any question and read it aloud, because as you say, it's not chronological, is that there's always some new group of people. Like, here's question 170. In the 1880s, where was Santa Fe's Italian neighborhood?
Right. I know.
We had an Italian neighborhood? Mm-hmm. We had a Little Italy? Where was it?
Well, you know where it came from. We're not going to answer these questions for you. You know that.
Oh, come on.
Oh, come on. Well, the folks who came in, a lot of the early Italians in that era came in to help work as stonemasons, right? And to work with the cathedral. And that was Bishop Lamy, who, although he was French, went after the Italians with their talent for stonemasonry. And these folks did very well and built a series of houses and naturally wanted to live kind of near each other. So, and Santa Fe is a town of neighborhoods. I like the fact that the center of town used to be the plaza, and now the center of town, well, I won't give that away, that's a question. But the center of town is now further south of town quite a bit. And yet we're still pretty
connected.
You mean
the geographical center?
The geographical center. Oh, the other center of town is wherever one's corazón is, right?
So what do you think of as somebody, Adrian Bustamante, who grew up in and around Santa Fe and spent much of your life here, although you've lived in other places as well, what do you think at this point is the center of town in terms of where people spend time, where you spend time?
Well, in my days, it was the plaza, which it had been for centuries. Now the heart of Santa Fe is still the plaza. That is, look at it like a wheel, a lot of spokes. Well, the hub is the plaza, and it still is. Now there are questions of maybe too many events in the plaza, all this kind of business. Well, but that's because... To me, it's almost an unreligious sacred space, if you want to call it that. That's what's important. That's the center. The rest are, you know, it's spread out. Santa Fe is much, much larger than when I was growing up here. I think there were 25,000 people then. But it's really the heart is the plaza. You identify with it. You know, that's where you think you're going to go celebrate, and so on.
Now, do you think that's left over from all the trails that came in here from the very beginning, from even before 1610, which pretty much most of us have agreed we've accepted? Would you say is the founding date for Santa Fe. There is some disagreement about that. Well, that's right. Our very last question. But because so many trails came in here, and as I say, Native American trails, a trading center, Ogopogay, is a name that people have decided to call what Santa Fe was back then. I think we're still connected. We like these trails of connectivity and trading, and that separates Santa Fe from other towns in New Mexico.
I think that we also have to realize that the Spanish way of settling and beginning towns and cities, there had to be a focal point where the government was to be, the church was to be, and also the marketplace. And that was how the plaza came about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the trails were extremely important, obviously. It brings people through here and so on. But the center, and it has remained the center, and we don't have to glamorize it and so on, because it has been the center for so long.
Now, what are the different trails that came into Santa Fe?
The main one was, which was the life support for northern New Mexico, for New Mexico, actually, at the beginning, was, of course, the Camino Real that started in, really, Mexico City, but Zacatecas and then, of course, Chihuahua were also places, marketplaces and so on. But there was a caravan very early that used to come in about every 3 years to supply Santa Fe with goods. Then in 1821, some of the Americans, individuals like Becknell, heard that Mexico had received its independence. Spain had really proscribed any trade with any other nations. It was a colonial power, and it wanted to control all the commerce and so on. Well, Becknell realized that, hey, the market's open now. And so he brought in a mule train and did so well that he came back, and that opened up the Santa Fe Trail. It was an old trail that Native Americans, they had trails all over this area and all over the Southwest, and all over the continental United States. Anyway, he followed that, came here, and that's the beginning of the Santa Fe Trail. Then in the 1880s, the railroads come in. We could call that a trail, you know, because the Camino Real extended all the way to Taos, and that made Santa Fe kind of the trading hub of northern New Mexico.
I also like the idea of remembering the old, what we call now the old Spanish Trail, but it's actually a designation for many, many routes to California. And so when you look at Santa Fe and you make a drawing of the railroad and these other trails, it's a wonderful kind of star, a center. And it's been a trading center of ideas and commodities and flesh. And it, therefore, is a very dramatic...
Flesh?
Yes.
What do
probably
you mean?
Things to eat.
Ah.
Things of other sorts, probably. You know, I could flesh that out in person sometime. People.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can go to the bookstore reading on Monday at Collected Works, and Elizabeth will talk about flesh with you personally.
Sure. This trading center, by the way, has a history of some challenging stuff and some challenging issues, including things having to do with Native Americans, Hispanic folks, all the other lump of us called Anglos. I like what you put in your introduction, Adrian, about that. That was great, because that term Anglo
means everybody.
All the others, all the rest of us.
Native or Spanish.
Yes.
Or Hispanic.
Maybe other people had this experience. When I first came to Santa Fe, I was put with a group of other Anglos, and there were some Native Americans in one group and some Hispanic folks in another group, and then all the rest of us. And it was such a marvelous motley group of people. We looked at each other and said, we've never been grouped together before.
What
and that's
was
a wonderful
it?
Thing.
African-American, Asian,
yes, Italian, European.
Right.
It was great. But there are challenging topics that are brought up and with relish in Santa Fe, and historians and other folks here don't shy away from addressing them. That doesn't mean they all agree. And I had a great time listening to the historians and the archivists and the archaeologists, etc., with whom I was working on this volunteer, all volunteer, I think, Adrian, wasn't it?
All volunteer.
The History Task Force. Mm. And I have to say, I was vastly impressed with the dignity and the humor and the tenacity with which these people addressed issues that were important. And they made me feel welcome. So I'm forever grateful for that experience. Some of the challenging questions that came up might have to do, for example, with Pompeii and the whole business of the war or the revolt.
Revolt.
And we address that in this book. There are other questions, even the Black Legend. I asked the fellow who's going to be talking about that, Penn Lafarge, whether or not I should include something about the Black Legend. And I asked Adrian, and he said, they both said yes.
Now, what is the Black Legend?
The Black Legend is that what has been put on Spain's shoulders of having been uniquely warmongering when they discovered the New World, goldmongering, suppression of the Native Americans, and so on. And so it became the Black Legend. And it really had to do with the attitude of England versus Spain and Spain versus England, because they hated each other. And a lot of it had to do with the religious wars that were going on. And what happened is then that a lot of American historians, early American historians, began to place the onus on the destruction of the Native Americans on Spain, when in fact Spain is the first one to pass laws that you could not enslave the I'm not whitewashing what conquistadores do. They come to conquer. And conquerors are horrible things that happen that we humans perpetrate. But anyway, and so they began to blame only Spain to take the onus away from them and place it on somebody else. And so that is the Black Legend, meaning it's a legend, okay? It's overemphasis on an awful lot of things for the sake of ethnic warfare and ethnic differences.
Yeah, I agree with Adrian. It was actually false propaganda about almost a whole race of people.
Yeah, not false.
And it became... Well, it's not entirely false,
no, but it was an overemphasis, and only they're the ones that did it. They were
yes,
cruel.
And that makes it false. I think whenever we are judicious about what we're looking at, when it's a tricky subject having to do with race, or politics, or how do we treat fellow people, it can get very tricky.
It's also tricky because you want to, on the one hand, have ethnic pride, especially if your ethnicity has been suppressed in one way or another or looked down upon, and on the other hand you want to tell the truth, whatever that is, in all its subtlety. And no one group is all good or all bad, and never has been and never will be, and so one wants to both show the good picture and show the true picture.
Right.
Ethnicity is what I really study in studying culture, the evolution of cultures. And that, you just gave us a very, very good answer and description of ethnic relationships there. Yeah, thank you.
You know, other challenging topics range from what exactly is a farolito versus a luminaria? And
I bet you're not going to tell us, Elizabeth.
I'm not. It's in the book. And most of us who live here know the difference.
Right.
Another challenging question that I'm not completely satisfied with our answer, we'll see what people think, is what are the Sirius Hills? Why are they called Sirius? Why did Sirius Road get its name? It's a complex answer. Mm. other things that can potentially be...
And the Cerrillos Hills means the hills, hills.
I know. I know. Isn't that hilarious? Right.
Hills, like, hills versus mountains. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's a little redundancy. It's a little bit like La Fonda Hotel.
Yeah,
it's,
right.
It's a cerro. A cerro is a mountain. Mm-hmm. And Cerrillos is a smaller, is smaller than a mountain, but not quite a hill. No loma. You have loma, hill. You have Cerrillos, a mound, we'd call it in English. And then, of course, you have the mountain.
Ah, right. Well, actually, Cerrito is a small hill, and Cerrillos means something else. So look on page 167.
Ladies and gentlemen.
But you can do that later. Other things that are challenging are, aside from the actual date of founding, are such things as how do people look at themselves? And I asked Ricardo Cate, who is a cartoonist from Santo Domingo, if he would contribute a cartoon.
Who does that terrific cartoon in the Daily Paper.
Yes, and he doesn't always please everybody all the time. But I think sometimes he's very funny, and he let me choose one, and one is in the book. It's great. Another thing that isn't exactly challenging, but I think is interesting, is where did the word churro come from? And that's in here, too, relating, oddly enough, to Sabanilla Labradora. So I ask one question in there, and that's on page 192, one question about some artwork, and then it goes from there to a bunch of other ideas, and many of the questions do that. And that's a reflection of how people talk about our history here. It's also a reflection of how the History Task Force managed these questions.
Well,
one would lead to another.
Not only are there questions and answers, but then for, I think, every single question, or almost most of the questions, there's references. For more information, go to this day in the Santa Fe New Mexican, or the Santa Fe Magazine, or this book. And so if you were to follow up on every single one of them, it would take you about a year to read this book.
Two years.
Right.
I think that was one of the things that we definitely wanted to include, because we want people to fully understand their the history of Santa Fe. And if they found a topic they were interested in, they could follow up. But it was important to open up to the public a bibliography such as this, so that they could really follow up on, you know, what they wanted to learn or understand about Santa Fe. So it's a very instructional book. It's not a trivia, as Elizabeth said. Mm-hmm. It's a book with important and, you know, trivial topics maybe, but it also, it's deeper. Where did this come from? What is the myth? What gave rise to this myth? And so on. The myth of Santa Fe, as we call it.
Now, the cover art on this book, we're talking about Santa Fe 400 Years, 400 Questions with Adrian Bustamante and Elizabeth West. What is this amazing image? And there's also a key to decode that image in the back of the book, but what is it?
It is based on the mural that City Hall, it's called Recuerdos y Sueños de Santa Fe, pardon my Spanish accent there. And it's as if somebody were flying over Santa Fe, full of its memories and people, and a mixture of dreams and memories. And you can see the big, gigantic mural in City Hall. It's pretty fascinating. And I decided that we should have the key to it. And I know there are quite a few people who are still alive who are in the picture. And some of them stand for other people in general, and others are just they themselves. For example, Amarante Tapia, who is pushing a broom, and the dust is rising up and coming up in the front of the faces of some of the people standing, including the Rios family. Evidently, he figured in a dream by the artist, Jerry West, who is... I think he won some awards here recently. I don't know.
Yeah, he's a recipient of the Mayor's Award for Excellence in the Arts this year.
As I think you are.
Yes.
That's right. She's being modest. Well, he had a dream about Amarante Tapia, and this mural was inspired by that dream. So it's pretty exciting. There are other fantastic murals around town, and Adrian and some other folks were involved with writing a little bit about the ones south of town at the municipal,
police court.
Yeah, the court down there, and Zara Kriegstein
magistrate
did
court,
those, okay. The magistrate court, and they are phenomenal murals. They give a whole history from a legal kind of point of view, jurisdiction point of view, of Santa Fe. So there's another way of looking at it.
It's such an endlessly rich city that we're living in. I mean, murals everywhere. Who knows about these things? Who's seen them? Maybe we'll start to explore them now, having heard about this from you just now, Elizabeth, or if you pick up a copy of the book. There are, five historical districts and three archaeological districts in the city of Santa Fe?
Yeah.
Who knew that? And it just goes on and on. And the book is full also of photographs from over 100 years of history, both current and archival photographs. And that must have been a job all by itself, selecting those.
Oh, that was fun. We decided that the book would be fun and entertaining just by itself. But we also thought, let's put some pictures in. Let's put some artwork in. Let's put some poetry in. And by the way, Joan Logie is going to come. She's accepted my invitation to come to the event on Monday, and is going to read the poem that's in here about music on the plaza.
Nice.
And there is a fabulous photograph in here on page 157 that Leroy Sanchez took. It was loaned to me, courtesy of Maurice Bonal. And it's of the Prince and Princess of Asturias, His Royal Highness and the Princess, who came in 2010 to visit Santa Fe. And it's a delightful photograph. I don't think it's ever been published before. There are other images that have never been published before. Penn Lafarge's mother, Consuelo Baca, is in a painting, a watercolor by Olive Rush, a prominent WPA artist. I saw it at his house when I was visiting. I said, Penn, couldn't we put that in the book? He said, well, I don't know. But he said yes.
Nice.
So there's a lot in here, and we had fun doing it. Perhaps some of the most fun are the ones where you get to go through the photo archives, those old pictures.
I know. I mean, just making the selection must be excruciating because there's so much to choose from. Now, there's another thing, which is the what is it pictures. What's that all about?
Even I got baffled by some of them.
Yeah.
I have to say Maurice Bernal did really well of the people I've shown them to. He didn't get them all, but he's probably the best so far. We put in small images throughout the book, and to make things less expensive, I confess, I took most of the pictures. And they're little snippets of places around town. For example, and I'm not going to tell the answer, there's one that looks as if it spells O-N.
Uh-huh.
Where is it? What is it? We don't know. There's some that are really tricky. There's one of a shadow on the grass. What the heck is that? There are answers, however.
And they're all in the back of the book.
That's right.
So it's great fun and lots more to talk about, but it's just about time to go. The book is called Santa Fe, 400 Years, 400 Questions, and Elizabeth West is the editor of the book. She's a retired librarian from the Santa Fe Public Library, and Adrian Bustamante is a retired historian of Southwest culture. He wrote the introduction to this book, which also gives us a very nice overview of the different periods of history of Santa Fe, from the Pueblo, well, even before Pueblo, you know, from the native period up through the present. And
he really did a good job. It's a very interesting, complete, and brief. But he didn't give away very many of the answers.
I tried not to.
That's right.
Now, there's a study guide in the back of the book.
Yes, and I was really pleased with that, that Elizabeth included that. Because this is also made for teachers. Teachers need resources. And that's another big reason why the committee was so interested in putting in a bibliography. It's for teachers to be able to prepare their lesson plans for their New Mexico history that they're supposed to be teaching. Unfortunately, we are one of the few states in the nation that does not require a course in at the high school level of the history of their state.
And really? That's crazy.
That. Yeah, it is.
That's
it
ridiculous.
Is. With all of the history here, 400 years of history or and more, and before that, you know, the Native Americans and so on, we are one of the nations that, I mean, one of the nations, now we're calling ourselves a nation, a state that does not really emphasize that.
You know, when I was in the eighth grade, I lived in rural upstate New York, and we had to do New York State history. And I had the world's best history teacher, and we learned about the Erie Canal and the Mohawk and Oneida and Onondaga, Cayuga, Seneca, right. Native Indians of that. I mean, we learned everything, and that's so important.
Mm-hmm. Very important.
Ladies and gentlemen in the Education Department of New Mexico, if you're listening to this,
yes.
take note.
And it's fun.
A whole year. You need a whole year.
All right. You probably do. Or more. I think the study guide that tells you how to give a dinner party, including some of the people you've met in this book, is so much fun. Because I love dinner parties. Can you imagine sitting next to Doña Tulis or Oñate or Pope and having them all at the same table?
Right. Well, the book, 400 Years, 400 Questions, is about Santa Fe and Elizabeth West. It will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Monday, the 27th of August at 6 in the evening. And we will see you on Monday at 6 at Collected Works Bookstore. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for having us.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Pamela McCorduck. She's author of the new novel, Bounded Rationality. And she will be reading and signing books on Saturday, August 25th at 2 in the afternoon at Garcia Street Books. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Charlotte. It's really nice to be here.
It's great to have you on the show. Now, this is a novel that is very wide-ranging. I mean, it covers love and family, and it covers mathematics and science and loss and grief and Santa Fe and New York City and a lot of things. It's the second book in a trilogy, and I wondered what was the starting point for you?
I was a visitor at the Santa Fe Institute some years ago in my own right. My husband happens to be on the external faculty there. And the ideas were just a natural thing for me because I had been writing about artificial intelligence most of my career. And so I found these ideas absolutely fascinating. And time went on, and I thought, can I possibly embody some of these wonderful ideas in a novel? And that novel turned out, at first, to be The Edge of Chaos, which was the first book I published. And I thought, oh, fine, end of project. No, not end of project. These people weren't through with me, and I wasn't through with them.
So it's the same characters?
Yes, some of the same characters. There are new characters in the second book, among them Leandro Torres, who is an architect, and Lucy Marchmont, who is a legal interpreter and translator.
And so it's interesting when you're using a novel as a vehicle for ideas, because by its nature it's far more than that, because it's not just a vehicle for ideas, it's people living and people having stories and people wrestling with the circumstances of their lives, and the ideas weave through those things and in fact help or sometimes hinder people from dealing with things.
Yes. And I've heard other novelists say this, in fact, as far back as Charlotte Bronte. The characters take on a life of their own. And so the process is more like discovery than invention. You think, as things are going along, don't do that. You will be so sorry if you do that. But he goes ahead and does it anyway. So what can you do?
Is that?
I wish I knew. It is almost like a channeling of a character. And this character comes to you. You have no idea where he has come from, for the most part. And you watch this character take on a life of his or her own, and there you are. You're just the medium. It sounds very mystical, but as I say, at least Charlotte Bronte felt the same way. So
Everybody feels the same way, or so many people do. And we were just having a conversation on the air with a cosmologist about whether, for example, mathematics was invented or discovered. And one wonders if there's a real analogy between that question. And, I mean, he came down squarely on the idea that mathematics is discovered, not invented. These characters are also discovered.
So it feels to me, because they surprise me, because I don't plan how the book is going to move or how it ends. But I know when I've reached the end.
Now, when you have a book like this, and there's quite a lot of characters in it, and it starts out in a way that seems maybe like a love story, an affair that might or might not go on. I mean, at the very beginning, I thought, these guys aren't going to make it. And, of course, like in real life, you don't know.
That's right.
But there's a lot of complexity to the relationships, because it's not just the two people to each other, but also children and colleagues, and then relationships to places.
Exactly.
Relationship to land, relationship to events in history, 9/11. And when you think about complexity, and here you are writing a book where one of the characters is at the Santa Fe Institute, do you think of your characters as being part of a, literally like a complex system?
Yes, very much so. And as you know, in complex systems, there are lots of moving parts. There are lots of interactions. Mostly, what happens in complex systems is that one change way over here will make another change way over here, totally unpredictable. And you cannot tell how it's going to turn out. And that's the way I feel about these people's stories. You know, how is it going to turn out? I don't know.
Now, one of our heroine, Judith, is a scientist and a mathematician, and she does have what I think you call, or she calls somewhere in the book, a computational approach to human relationship
yes,
problems.
She does. And luckily, the people who love her tolerate this.
Right. But it doesn't necessarily work very well, or does it?
No. Well, that the reader will have to judge. But people who love her, including her very close friend Ron, who's known her since they were children, and of course her husband, they're okay with that. They're okay with that. It's a refreshing change. Her husband's first wife was hysterical, and he says, I love your rationality. So there you are.
Right, right. Now, there are questions brought up, and I think this is probably one of the themes, is about questions of appearance versus reality.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It is very explicit in the work of one of the daughters of one of the characters. She's an artist, or she's trying to be an artist, and she realizes that one of the things that she's going to have to do is deal with the appearances under reality. And she realizes that she's written, you know, essays in college about this, but she's never really dealt with the issue, and that is her task. Many other people have the same thing. The son, sister to this woman, spends a lot of time trying to figure out what his dreams are all about, because they're so strange. And which is the appearance? Which is the reality? It's not entirely clear.
Right. And then it's all kind of meta, because you're writing a novel.
That's true.
Where you're basically creating or discovering a reality.
Yes, right, right, right.
Now, one of the things that's nice about the book for those of us who live in New Mexico is that a lot of it takes place here.
Oh, it's very much bound to the geography of northern New Mexico. After 9/11, several of the characters go to a place where they feel comforted and happy and serene once again. One of those is the Dwan Light Sanctuary, which is just north of Las Vegas. Another is La Plaza Blanca, which is near Georgia O'Keeffe territory. These places mean a great deal to these characters. They want to be there. They need to be there. It is a comfort to them.
And it's a comfort to them for all kinds of reasons, and one of the reasons goes back to mathematics.
Well, as that turns out, yes. Judith, the mathematician, goes to the Dwan Light Sanctuary, and she's never somehow been there before. And the moment she walks in, she starts looking at the mathematics that have gone into the planning of this place, and she's absolutely enchanted by this, until finally she says, get over yourself, you know. This is a place for meditation, for contemplation, for consolation. And that's what happens. But she has to go through the mathematical steps first.
Right. Well, I was wondering as I was reading that, maybe that was kind of her consolation.
Yeah, in lots of ways it is. Sure. Yeah.
Now, when you're writing a place where one of the characters is from a local institution, namely the Santa Fe Institute, do you have to be careful of making sure the characters aren't actually too close to any one person?
Yeah, I want to be able to go back. The Institute has been wonderfully tolerant, maybe even supportive, I should say. Chris Wood, the vice president, has been really kind about making sure that everybody on the staff knows that the book is out. The work that one of the characters does, Mikey Torres, who is the son of the architect, is in fact the work done by Jeff West. And Jeff West and his colleagues, he's got a big team of people, where they're trying to wrestle with the idea of, can you have a scientific notion of how cities work? Well, this is bizarre to some people. It's fascinating to me, it's fascinating to them, it's fascinating to a lot of people, and that is what Mikey Torres is working on, and how this architect, who is world famous, happened to come to this little town of Santa Fe. He wants to be with his family. He's lonely for all the glitz and whatnot that surrounds his life. He's lonely. He wants a family connection.
And I think what I like about the novel, and I was thinking about this when Rebecca Goldstein was here and we talked to her on this show about one of her novels. She's a philosopher who is also a novelist, or a novelist who's, which way is it go? Anyway, is that the novel is the place where, first of all, you can embody ideas,
right,
and you can basically integrate or try to integrate everything you know.
Yes. When you look at what these characters are doing in this book, it's basically my lifetime of experience. What I love in music, what I love in art, what I love in architecture. I had help. Please, don't get me wrong. I had a couple of architects help me out, and one emailed me this morning who's just read it and said, hey, you got that part right. I can't speak to the other parts, but you got the architecture completely right, and you said some things I've never heard. So I was very pleased with that. So I turn to topics that I've known superficially and say, okay, I really want to know more about this. What can I know? And that's what I did with the work of West and his colleagues. I knew it superficially. I sat down and read scads of papers to bring it into two or three paragraphs like that.
And the trick is making it not peripheral, but actually integral to the themes of the book.
Yes, you've got to do that. I could have written essays about a dozen different topics. These are the ones that my characters are concerned with, and therefore I've got to spend some time being concerned with.
We're talking to Pamela McCordick about her novel Bounded Rationality. Now, what is the meaning of that term, the title?
This is a term that was originally coined by a Nobel laureate economist, a man by the name of Herbert Simon. And what he meant by that is that people intend to behave rationally. And in fact, in classical economics, you'll hear the phrase rational man. Well, there is no such thing. And
yeah, that's an oxymoron.
Yeah, just about. But we do intend it. We intend to be rational, but our rationality is bounded. And it's bounded by what we know. It's bounded by how much time we have to think about an issue. It's bounded by how much information we can find about an issue. It's bounded, limited is another word, in lots of ways. The phrase became bounded rationality, so that's why I used it. And Herb was a friend of mine, and I was delighted to be able to give this little tribute to him. Not that he needs it from me, but it really was an homage to a wonderful, wonderful human being.
And when you think about all the things that the people in your book go through, they're things that really can't be solved by dealing with rational processes. I mean, you've got family, deep, deep generational family problems. You've got substance abuse and addiction and all those kinds of things.
No, it's you cannot reason your way out of a lot of these things. And you cannot reason your way out of grief. You must endure it.
Right. And that's another thing that I thought was nice. I mean, difficult, obviously. But the way that people deal with grief and the way that dealing or not dealing makes other things worse and
yes.
You're watching it go by and you don't seem to be able to do anything about it. And it's just hard.
It's very hard. And this is part of grown-up life. Things happen in the happiest of lives, and you think, this can't be happening to me.
Right.
But it does.
Well, and that's another thing. It's all the... starting the book, here are these two golden people getting on a private jet, reading the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and I think, blech.
Some very nice people read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal.
I know, but on a private... I don't know. That says more about me than it does about them, but here they are, and you think, wow, these privileged people with their lovely lives, and the guy knows how to make money, and he's made a lot of it, and again, that's the appearance, and the
yes.
reality underneath that is that there's a lot of burdens on him and on both of them caused precisely by their success.
Yes, partly by their success, and partly by where they have come from themselves. You learn after a while that this very wealthy man who is setting up a foundation based on the principles of complexity has in fact never known his own father. And even his wife doesn't know what a tremendous wound this is to him. When 9/11 comes, and it happens in the course of the book, his father shows up in his office, and he's absolutely undone. This is a man who has, frankly, ruined firms, brought down governments, and he cannot cope with the biological fact of his own father. He is simply undone.
So this is the second in the trilogy. Now, was it while you were writing this that you realized that there was a third book?
Yes. At the end of the second book, I thought, oh, but there are so many things I need to explore yet. And my editor said, you really got to tie this one up and tie that. And I said, no, it's already long enough. I'll write a third one. That's when it became a trilogy. So that's, 250 manuscript pages long. And
So we'll be seeing you back here at this table soon.
I hope so.
The book is called Bounded Rationality. It's the second novel in a trilogy by Pamela McCorduck, and she will be reading and signing books this coming Saturday, August 25th at 2 o'clock at Garcia Street Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's always a pleasure.